2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 355, What Do We Make of the News Out of Colorado City? A paper presented by Ken Driggs with a response by Hillary Groutage.
She continued when she moved to the Salt Lake Tribune in 1996 and was part of a team that produced a project on recent events within the fundamentalist community. And I will allow them to go ahead and begin, and then we will have some question and answers at the end. Thank you.
I had this elaborate outline all prepared for myself to sort of work from today, and I could not tell you where it is at the moment. So this is going to be pretty extemporaneous. What I thought I'd like to do is just tell you a little bit about myself and my connection with the community. When I first started thinking about this, I was thinking along the lines of what the hell is going on down in Colorado City, trying to explain that and put it into some context. But I want to make it clear, and my comments I think will make this pretty evident, is that I'm not here to bash those folks or to add to what I think are a lot of unfortunate stereotypes about them. I'm just trying to put some of what I think is going on into a context. Let me start by saying, you've heard this, some of you who are in earlier sessions probably have heard this before, it is important to understand that fundamentalist Mormonism is a wide community with a lot of different parts to it. Many are people who would call themselves independents. They are not affiliated with a particular group. There are a number of different groups. The groups have had a tendency to divide over time and create more groups. I frankly, in the time that I've been looking at these folks, I've found not an inconsequential number of people with one foot in the church and one foot in fundamentalism. So it is important to know that when you read about Tom Green, for instance, and his trials, you are not reading about something, you're not getting information that you can safely attribute to all fundamentalist groups. There are significant differences. The differences include some of the obvious, or the way they dress and present themselves. They have some differences in attitudes of doctrine. Many times there are differences in feelings of leadership, who they feel has the keys or authority to, that they recognize as a leader of their group, and different attitudes just towards those keys in particular and maybe towards the church in general. So the things that are said about and attributed to Colorado City, and I think a lot of them are inaccurate at the moment, and I'll talk about that in a minute, you shouldn't necessarily think apply to all the other groups, to other fundamentalist Mormons. Now, I suppose in the interest of fairness, let me disclose my attitudes and my contact with this community. I think the first time I went to Colorado City was January 2nd or 3rd, 1988. I had seen in the months before a segment on 60 Minutes about some dispute going on there, and I remember at the time thinking, whoa, I'm sixth generation Mormon. I didn't know there were fundamentalist Mormons. I'm living in the Deep South where all the Baptists think we have one big eye in the middle of our forehead and eat our firstborn. And that was just kind of interesting to me, so I had a long break from my job and went to the community a couple of days after New Year's in 1988 and just kind of talked my way in. One of the first people I met was Dan Barlow, who was the mayor at the time, had been a mayor for a long time, or continued to be, and one of his brothers, Sam Barlow, who was involved with some litigation. Sam was sort of a litigation director there, or not director, but involved with a lot of their litigation. And shortly after that, I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in legal history. And I, as a thesis, I wrote about the Vera Black case. It's a 1955 Utah Supreme Court decision where the Utah Supreme Court basically said fundamentalist Mormons and polygamists are subhuman, they're not worthy of any contact with their children, and therefore if you find out they're in a polygamous relationship, you can take their kids away from them. And they took Vera Black's kids from her. It is held out in law school classes in juvenile law as an example of the furthest, most extreme reach of juvenile court judges. So I researched that thesis, and Marianne Watson did some research for me. Some of you folks here may know Marianne, and Marianne was able to find some documentation that just floored me to this day, indicating that that case was rigged in advance by basically the attorney generals of Utah and Arizona and some social work officials. I was just floored to find the documentation that essentially showed that case was rigged It was the kind of thing that would get you disbarred today, but I guess in the 50s it didn't count if you're going after fundamentalist Mormons. And as a result of that, I started getting involved with some litigation that came out of Colorado City. Three times I was retained as an expert witness to testify about them in trials. The most recent time was the Rodney Holm prosecution, criminal prosecution in St. George last August. The judge would not let me testify, so we did this long proffer, and I never hit the witness stand. In the course of the time that I've been going down there, I've probably visited the community 50 times. I've spent as much as a week at a time there. I have visited with families. I've been a guest in their homes and spent the night in their guest rooms. I've eaten at their dinner tables. I've played with their kids. I've watched their kids grow up. I've gone to their social functions. I've gone to funerals. I've gone to church services, their main sort of afternoon meeting that I think mainstream Mormons would associate with sacrament meeting. I've never been to a priesthood meeting. It's clear to me that there are a number of things that I've not gone to. It is evident to me that while sometimes they were anxious to put their best foot forward and leave me with leave a positive impression with me, I've had hundreds of hours of conversations with people about their lives and religious lives when I was not really, you know, the out-of-town expert writing stuff down, just talk with friends. And frankly, I cannot believe that the impressions I got in all of that time were all staged and rigged. I feel like I have a pretty good feel for people in that community, both people who have been excommunicated in some of the recent sort of purges down there, and people who are still, as far as I know, active participants in the community. While that process was going on, I also made a number of friends in the Allred community and have attended their religious meetings, consider Owen Allred to be a particularly good friend of mine, and have enjoyed a lot of really wonderful social contacts with them. Now, I mention that because it gives me something to compare Colorado City with, I guess. And so the bias that I bring to you is that I consider these folks largely to be friends. I do not agree with everything they do by any means. But I think I have a good look at the community. I think because I've regarded them as friends and they regarded me as a friend, I've been exposed to things that many outsiders would not be exposed to. And so when I get to the point of talking about some of the affairs, current affairs down there, you should take it in that context. I think it might be helpful to give a quick kind of history of fundamentalist Mormonism for those of you that may not be familiar with it. Many of you know, of course, the church in 1890 issued something called the Manifesto, which is now included in Scripture, and was an indication that the plural marriage, religiously based plural marriage, was being discontinued. Well, it didn't be discontinued in 1890. It actually continued well into the administration of Joseph F. Smith, who in 1904 issued something called the second, or is generally called the second manifesto. It actually wasn't the second, it was probably about the 20th, basically saying we're not doing this anymore. But then it was said in the context of the Reed-Smoot hearings, and there really was an effort to sort of tighten up, and two members of the Quorum of the Twelve were dropped from the Quorum of the Twelve, one excommunicated and one disfellowshipped because of their continued support for plural marriage, one of those being John W. Taylor, a son of John Taylor. And then Joseph F. Smith died, and he was succeeded as president by Heber J. Grant, who actually himself had been had plural families, and in 1899 himself was convicted of a post-manifesto plural marriage offense. He actually pled guilty to it. But as president of the church, was determined to end this practice and to drive those traditionalists out of the church who continued to do it. A number of stake patriarchs were excommunicated. It seems to have been done a lot by stake patriarchs. There were these investigations by the Quorum of the Twelve, some of which were triggered by exposés in the Salt Lake Tribune around 1909, 1910. Those are interesting to me because my great-great-grandfather, Apollos Griffin Driggs, is the subject of some of those exposés. He's mentioned in some of the same articles with Joseph White Musser, who was an early leader of fundamentalism. But anyway, in the course of Grant's administration, the pressure really goes on these traditionalists. And in 1933, the church issues something called the Final Manifesto, which is this long legalistic sort of document. They start a lot of excommunications. The legislature increases the criminal penalty for polygamy from a misdemeanor to a felony. While this is going on, in 1929, a man named Lauren Woolley, a son of a man named John W. Woolley, begins to organize a priesthood council. That's one of the terms you hear for it, which is kind of a governing body regulating the affairs, to some extent, of fundamentalist Mormons. It's a 7-member body. And as Grant drives these people out of the church, they begin to coalesce around this body, although there's not always a consensus amongst fundamentalists themselves about how things should operate. In 1944, there is a major raid, a multi-state raid, where a lot of fundamentalist Mormons are rounded up and prosecuted. In 1935, by the way, they have begun publishing a monthly magazine called Truth, which is basically just reproduces an awful lot of 19th century Mormon stuff on plural marriage and also kept track of church doings on the subject. But after the 44 raid, 15 men were imprisoned. They got sentences of 5 years to serve. None of them actually served the 5 years. They were all paroled somewhat earlier than that. But they were all generally would have been regarded as leaders, I think, in the church. They may not have, in the fundamentalist community, they may not have seen themselves that way. But among them was John Y. Barlow, who at that point was the senior member of the quorum of their priesthood council, and Joseph White Musser, who was next behind John Y. Barlow, I suppose, in ordination, and had been the editor of Truth magazine. Well, after a number of months, they were given the opportunity to sign a pledge indicating that they would not continue to practice plural marriage. And a number of them did, and they were paroled early. And when their period of their parole was over, they all promptly went back to the lifestyles that they previously knew. 3, I believe it was, refused to sign the pledge and ended up having to serve an additional period of time before they were eventually paroled. Well, while they're in prison, Joseph Musser begins to have a series of strokes, which interfered with his ability to speak and make himself clearly understood. While he was in prison, he had given over the editorship of Truth magazine to his son, Guy. When he comes out, he attempts to regain control of Truth. His son, Guy, won't give it up to him, and Guy continues to be the editor of Truth. In 1949, John Y. Barlow dies. And the next senior member of the Quorum of the Twelve is Brother Musser. And he wishes to designate, essentially as his successor and another member of the priesthood council, a man named Rulin Allred. Rulin is the brother of Owen Allred, who's now the leader of what's called the Allred Community, the Apostolic United Brethren. And a majority of the pre-existing priesthood council just refused to go along with it. To make a long story short, they reach an impasse, and the groups split when Brother Musser, Owen, or Joseph Musser, calls a new priesthood council that includes a number of his brothers. And then he dies in 1954. So Colorado City has gone off in they're off in another direction. It depends on, I guess, which side of the divide you find yourself as to who you think is the original priesthood council, but they divide. And there are still members that are independents that are not necessarily affiliated with these groups. Well, one of the things that happens in the course of their evolution after the split is that the Allred group continues to have a functioning priesthood council. Owen Allred is now 90 or 91 and is pretty infirm. He's pretty much housebound. He's a very sweet, nice man. I visited with him a couple of days ago, but he's just clearly in the latter part of his life. But they have a council that continues to function and run the affairs of the church. While I have never been privy to a council meeting, it's always been my impression that a council is a council with a collection of men with a variety of life experiences and ideas, and they talk about issues, and as a body they make decisions for their religious community. Well, what's happened down in Colorado City is they've evolved in a different direction where they no longer seem to have a functioning council. They've evolved to something that they now call, I believe, one man rule or one man doctrine, but essentially one guy presides over that religious community. After the split, it was a man named Leroy Johnson, who died in 1986. He was succeeded by a man named Rulin Jeffs, who was a returned missionary for the church. And when he died in 2002, I guess it was, he was succeeded by his son, Warren Jeffs. Warren is now the leader of that community down there. Warren was at one time headmaster of a private kind of parochial school they had up here in one of the canyons. And has become the leader of the community, and it appears to me that many of the more serious problems they have right now have kind of coincided with Warren's administration. Colorado City also, since at least 1943, and they really started this in the 1930s, has attempted to live a united order communalism. Now, the All Red people do this too, as do some other fundamentalist Mormon groups, but they're all a little different. And what's happened in Colorado City is they have something called the United Effort Plan, which basically owns the land, the title to all of the, not all, but the vast majority of the homes and businesses and so on down in Colorado City. And this is administered by a board of trustees, and the president of the church, who is considered prophet, presently Warren Jeffs, presides over that. As I understand the trust instrument now, all of the other members of the board serve at his pleasure exclusively, which effectively gives him pretty complete control over the administration of those lands, including who's allowed to live where. There was a very bitter and expensive lawsuit between a dissenting group and this majority group, I guess, that went all the way to the Utah Supreme Court in the, I guess it started in the late 80s and went to the Utah Supreme Court by 1991. And as I understand it, the division that created the Centennial Park community is tied into that litigation. But that Supreme Court, as I understand the Utah Supreme Court's decision, essentially affirmed the power and structure of this United Effort Plan instrument. But the Supreme Court split the baby a little bit. They did give some people what they call life estates in the homes that they had resided in, which basically means you can live there until you die, but you can't sell this land or give someone else legal title to it. One of the issues, I've got an article coming out in the in Dialogue in the next year or so, whatever their publishing time frame is, about the priesthood split. And then going back through some diaries I looked at the time and other sort of personal records, it appears that kind of a secondary issue behind the split was that Musser was opposed to the marriage of underage women as brides, and apparently had expressed that feeling. And also believed that the parents or priesthood head should approve of a marriage before they took place. And I think there were some people in Colorado City who had a different take on that. I don't mean to suggest that underage brides and basically kidnapped brides was the practice down there, but I think it happened from time to time. I know of some families where that has happened. I don't want to identify them here, but I've talked to some people whose children were involved in that sort of thing, and even though the kids are now very adult, that's still an issue with some of those parents. Okay, so that's a bit of a background kind of leading you up to what is being said now. I did a piece on a recent issue of Sunstone about John Krakauer's book, which I read somewhat reluctantly. Everybody has their own take on that book, I guess. I read the book like he was saying everybody down there in those communities is a pedophile and a child molester and is molesting their own kids and everything. Maybe I was reading too much into it, but I found the book to be quite inaccurate and just tarred these folks in a way that I disagreed with. And I disagreed with it because of what I saw. I mean, I have been in those homes, I've played with those kids, I've corresponded with a lot of those people, and I just didn't see the kind of horror stories that it was portrayed in his book. Now, anytime you get a community that large of several thousand people, there are going to be some bad apples. I have no doubt there are some bad apples down there. I have no doubt that there have been occasional incidents of things like that. But I've never seen anything that indicated to me that it was disproportionate to that rate of incidents of that sort of thing in the society at large. I think they've got themselves in a situation now, or the climate out here now is such that almost any stereotype that is thrown out about them is believed, and when there seems to be no evidence to support that, and a lot of times I don't see any real evidence to support some of these allegations, because it's such a closed community and nobody's prepared to acknowledge that maybe there isn't a basis for these claims. One of the people who was excommunicated last January, when they excommunicated a number of people from the community, was Dan Barlow, the mayor of the community. I think Well, let me back up a little bit. Part of what the tension, I think, has been in that community for 10 years or more has been those who believed that in order to survive and live successfully, they needed to be engaged with the outside world as successfully as possible. That you can't avoid the fact the rest of the world is here. I've had a lot of conversations with Dan, the mayor, about that on the issue of our young men, he spoke mostly about young men, but I'm sure I know it applies to the women as well, need jobs. Somebody's got to buy the food, somebody's got to buy the gas for the car to meet the daily needs, and this only happens when you've got jobs and economic involvement with the outside community. And I know from a lot of conversations with Dan Barlow, that was a priority with him. Now, there's obviously another school of thought down there that was opposed to their being involved with the outside world. Some of you may recall, I guess it was in fall of 2000, when they largely withdrew their kids from public schools and homeschooled them. Well, that I think part of that was this debate about involvement and engagement with the outside world. I think one of the downsides of that was that an awful lot of their people were teachers and administrators in the school, and when they withdrew from that, those people ended up doing the same work for free in many instances in their parochial schools and lost that income. I think that put a lot of financial pressure on the community or added to it. There was a time before that when they were urged to gather, because they had fairly significant numbers in Salt Lake and in other areas, but to return to collect the faithful down to Colorado City. And I think many times that was done with an economic price. I do know, I don't know how many people have been over here. I know the Centennial Park people are familiar with this. But there's a big manufacturing concern down there called Western Precision, which is a pretty large business that has millions of dollars worth of billing around the country. Well, they relocated from the Salt Lake Valley with the help of the community down there. They're a major employer in the community. They're majorly engaged with the outside world. And their presence does bring some money into the community, but it's not enough to keep them all afloat, I don't think. There has recently been a civil lawsuit initiated against Warren Jeffs and the community, I gather. I haven't seen the pleadings, but as I understand it, on allegations of his sexually molesting, he and two of his brothers, I think, sexually molesting a cousin, I think it is, when he was a young child. I personally find that very hard to believe, just knowing what I know about Warren. It's going to be, I guess, up to a court of law at some point to deal with that. I just have a hard time believing that there's a real basis from that, knowing what I know about the people and knowing that that's, the community would tolerate that sort of thing, everybody in general down there. I'm running out of time, and I want to be sure we have time for questions. Let me just mention a couple of philosophical points I want to get into. I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and one of the basic tenets we have in criminal defense law, and I tell this to every jury that I've got to argue in front of, in our society, we believe that it is more important to not convict the innocent than to be sure we get all the guilty. That's why we have a bunch of rules that protect criminal defendants. That's one of our constitutional liberties. I think we have that same set of concerns in religious issues. I personally, as a matter of philosophy, believe that religion is none of the government's business, that people are free to make their own choices about their religious affiliation and practices. And I think that in order to guarantee that freedom for ourselves, we have to be prepared to give that freedom to other people, even when we strenuously, strongly, absolutely disagree with their decisions. Constitutional liberties and freedoms aren't a matter of whether we agree with people. It's a matter of whether we're prepared to tolerate and allow people to make decisions that we strongly disagree with in order to protect our own freedoms. And I think, as in criminal law, where our rules to protect the innocent guarantee that some of the guilty are going to get away with it, I think our rules of religious liberty, if they're administered in the way I certainly think they should be, guarantee that there's going to be some people making bad religious choices. We are occasionally going to have children die because their parents, for religious beliefs, won't allow them to get medical treatment. We are apparently going to occasionally have children lose the kind of education we might hope they have because of their parents' beliefs about education, as with Amish and Hutterites and other Anabaptist groups. And the issue isn't whether these are decisions that we would agree with or whether they are smart decisions. The issue is they are our decisions. taking a step back, many times these decisions have to do with how we treat and raise our children. And I've been a lawyer long enough to where I'm not real comfortable just saying that the government should be in a position of setting a set of rules and standards for how people should raise their children. I think that's an individual personal level, a personal decision, that we need to set sort of very broad parameters that try to protect children as much as possible. But I don't know that we want to get ourselves in a situation where we're letting some government agency or some politician come into a home and start telling us how we can raise our kids. It frequently becomes a matter of what the political wind every 4 years is and who wins an election. I just don't think that that's an area that we should be having the government involved in our homes. I think at this point, maybe the best thing for me to do would be to step back and allow the Tribune to be heard. And I would like to try to address questions as much as possible from my standpoint. I'll give you a straight answer if I can give you a straight answer. If I don't have an answer to it, I'm not going to give you an answer. I want to mention one thing about law. I keep saying I'm going to shut up and I don't. One of the earlier sessions mentioned a little bit a United States Supreme Court decision called Lawrence versus Texas. It's frequently referred to as the gay sex case that came down a while ago. It was kind of an amazing decision, particularly when you consider who some of the justices were that wrote parts of it. But I think Lawrence now makes it clear that the state may not prosecute consenting adults for polygamous relationships. I think it doesn't mention Reynolds, but I think it effectively overrides Reynolds. And I just don't see that the criminal prosecution of consenting adults is viable anymore. But one of the things that runs through Lawrence is they make it very clear, adult, 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 adult. Every justice writing talks about, we are talking about consenting adults. I don't read anything in Lawrence that extends its protections to people below the age of 18. Now, there may be some equal protection or other kinds of concerns about marriages, plural marriages, or any kind of marriage with when there's an age difference and one is an adult and one is not, but Lawrence doesn't address that issue. But I think, I just don't see that the criminal prosecution of consenting adults in polygamous relationships based on religion or anything else that wants to motivate you is possible anymore under Lawrence. I think that door has been nailed shut by the Supreme Court unless they are prepared to reverse themselves in Lawrence. With that, I will sit down and shut up for a minute.
Him to sit down. He's so smart. I'm Hillary Groutage, and just a tiny bit of background. What time is it, Mary?
7:43.
Okay.
You got a half hour.
Thanks. In 1988, I was traveling a lot to southern Utah because my folks were kind enough to build a second home there that they never used. So I got to use it, and as a poverty-stricken reporter, single mother, it was like the perfect getaway, and it was also 7 miles from Colorado City. So I shopped there, and I played in the parks and whatever, and before long, some of the people working on our home started chattering about this UEP suit that Ken talked about. So that was my introduction to this community, was covering that quagmire of property dispute that arose when people sued to have the right to stay in the homes that they'd been in for lo these many years. So that was my introduction. In 2000, I had moved over to the Tribune and was an education writer when the edict came down to pull all the kids out of public school. So I was making treks down there all the time, but made another trek to cover that story. And found indeed that things were changing a little bit in the town and things felt a little bit different than they had in the past. And then fast forward to January when I was in St. George taking a nice break, and my folks by then had disbanded our wonderful getaway, darn it. But I was down there for a convention and I got a call. This is just terrible, and if you repeat this outside of this room, I'll deny it. But here's how out of touch the editors at the Tribune were. I get this call, I'm at dinner, it's like 8 o'clock at night. The night editor at the Tribune goes, "Hey, you think you could go phone up Dan Barlow? We need to talk to him. He's gone." And you know, it was just ridiculous. I was like, I don't know where he is. I will never find him, and he will certainly not talk to me on this day. And I knew immediately that something had changed drastically in this town that I had become quite fond of. I liked hanging out there. I liked shopping there. I never felt threatened there. My kids were, you know, the people in the store were always helpful. The house, the workers were great. So I knew on that night when I drove back into Colorado City, just the feeling, everything was different. Nobody would talk to me in the store, and everyone was clammed up, and I thought, oh, something has occurred here. And indeed, we now know something really had occurred. So the Tribune launched, it kind of grew from that little request, go chat with Dan Barlow, to do a bigger look at what Warren Jeffs had been doing down there and how this whole situation had evolved. And the product of that, in part, is sitting back there, so take more if you need more. But it was we assembled a team of reporters that happened to be all women, and we were freed from our duties at the Tribune for about 2 months to go hang out in like the most beautiful corner of this state and Arizona. And I see a lot of familiar faces out here. And I have to say in the beginning that I too have a little bit of a bias, because as I was in these homes and chatting with these wonderful people, I thought, I was a single Mormon mom struggling with these two kids, and it was really, really hard. And I see the community structure. These kids in these communities were never alone. They always had playmates. There was no need for daycare, no after-school problems. It seemed like they were always taken care of. They were happy. They had places to go, things to do. And just as Ken said, I'm sure there are social problems in those communities that plague any community of that size in any state in the nation. But it was not my experience, just as Ken said, it was not my experience that these children are abused and forced into a dreadful life. That said, I did encounter some distressing fallout from especially the decision to pull kids out of public school. I ran into a lot of kids who were now teenagers who said, well, you know, I stopped going to school when Warren told us to, and I don't read, and I don't do math, and I don't have any job skills, and now I'm kicked out of the community, and I'm just kind of hanging out with my pals. And that was the most distressing thing I found in the course of this project, was this population of teenagers, roughly the ages of my kids. So of course I wanted to gather them all up and take them home with me, because they were just kind of lost, and a lot of that could be traced back to that edict to pull kids out of the public schools. So that was something that I found quite distressing. Are there any questions before I just keep blabbing on?
We've all heard, I think, that it's forbidden to talk to outsiders, and that people have been disciplined or kicked out for talking to outsiders, and it sounds like you didn't encounter that. Is that because you were considered to be local and trusted, or...
You know, I think there was a time when the Barlow brothers probably spoke to me, probably not as freely as to Ken, maybe because I'm a woman, I don't know. I've had a lot of good conversations with Alvin Barlow and Sam, and not so recently, Dan. What I found is there were always people available to talk with me if I begged and pleaded and told the attorneys, you know, get me someone to talk to, because the story's going to come out and we're going to do this project and we're going to do it whether they talk to us or not. So it would be better for them and everybody if, you know. So I know a couple of times I was kind of nursing sources along, and I would phone them in Colorado City and their numbers would be disconnected. And one night in particular, I just went into utter panic because I was pretty sure that this gentleman had been disciplined, and you know, I thought it was probably my fault because I'd kind of talked him into talking to me. And so I roused their Salt Lake attorney. It was really late at night. I'm so embarrassed that I did this. And he got Sam Barlow, who went and got the guy, who brought him back to the office, and they called me back and said, oh, I just forgot to pay my phone bill. And I thought, you know, like, who would be disciplined for talking to me, first of all? Warren Jeff doesn't care about me. So, you know, that said, there is a different feel in that town. And there's a different feel than there was 10 years ago. There's a different feel than there was 2 years ago. So they've kind of clammed up. But I mean, yes, it's not like you wanted to go knock on a door and say, chat with me about your lifestyle. But it was, there are ways.
I think we've heard in the press that in some of these recent purges, the expelled leaders, namely the Barlows and some others, were disinvested of their wives and children at the same time. And that seems so strange to me because I don't really understand the community down there. But do you or Ken perhaps have a sense for what is really going on with that? I mean, do these women say, okay, that's fine, or are they under such menacing threat of punishment that even though they don't want to part with their husband, they don't have any other options? It just, the whole thing is completely unimaginable to me. You think that they would find out where their husband was and they just run right after wherever he went. But apparently they're not doing that. So are they robots, or what is the story?
Well, they're not robots, but let me tell you a joke. Because I was in Colorado City not long ago and I had breakfast with one of my friends, and he said, I've got a joke for you. Because there has been a lot of shifting around of families down there. And this is occurring, and some women think it's okay, and clearly some do not. So here's the joke. Knock, knock.
Yeah.
Father. That's terrible, but I didn't make it up. Anyway, I have heard from, of course, only the women who are upset and leaving, and then you hear kind of through the grapevine, well, my mom has had it, so she's gone, and she... So I don't believe they're robots, and I do believe that when things become unbearable down there, there will be women who take their children and leave, and there have been women who have taken their children and left.
Is it not unbearable already?
I would say no. If they are believers and faithful and committed to this lifestyle and this community, and Brother Jeff's, you know, mixes things up a little bit and they believe he's the prophet, I think for a time there are going to be women who do that. There are women who have told me, this is what I do, this is what I'm doing. And a lot of times I think too, if you think about it, and you have a bunch of kids and you're on your own and the law is squishy about custody, and are you a first wife or a second wife or a third wife, or, you know, you don't want to walk away and leave your seven kids, just it gets really squishy. That's what I've found.
I was going to add a couple of details to that. We ought to both just stand up here so that we deal with both these questions. Just for those of you who don't know, when you hear us refer to the Barlows, these are almost entirely sons of John Y. Barlow, who had plural wives, and he had a number of sons who were very prominent people in the community. It looks to me like all of the Barlows in any leadership role are now pretty much out, have been excommunicated.
Except Sam.
And I think Sam's status in the community is altered somewhat. I'll just put it that way. I have to tell you that my own take, I know these men, many of some better than others, the idea of them being excommunicated because they are disloyal to the community somehow, I just don't accept. Because I felt like I knew them pretty well, and I knew how committed I believed or perceived that they were to the community. It is my understanding, and has been, people have explained this to me, and you might, people closer to the community may have may explain it to you differently, that they do believe that the prophet is inspired of God as to who should marry whom. And that at a point in life when young women are perceived to be prepared or ready for marriage, they are turned into the priesthood by their priesthood head, generally their father, but it may be someone else if the father's not it. And that the prophet determines what is an appropriate marriage for them and to whom. That this system in the past has tried to accommodate likes, you know, that they may have already had pre-existing sort of connections or relationships, and it sometimes may well be people that they hadn't thought about. That seems strange to people who are not in the community, but you're talking about a community where this has apparently been the practice for a long time. It sounds like the majority of the community has faith and confidence in this practice, and nobody puts a gun to their head, that they did have the right to say, no, I'm not prepared to do this. And I think sometimes those marriages don't take and people have left. I'm not offering that up to you to say you should all come down and become part of this process. I'm offering that up to you to say this is a process that's been in this community for a long time. The community seems to have faith in it, and it is not forced. Now, there may be some of what people would regard, we might regard as coercion, but I think those are the sort of social stigmas that might come to apply if some 19-year-old Mormon kid says, hell no, I'm not going on a mission, when he gets a mission call. So, I don't know that it is just sinister by its description or should be received that way.
There was a question over here.
What do you project happening short-term and long-term in Colorado?
Well, I mean, I think if the leadership down there continues to conduct business in a way that makes large numbers of the community uncomfortable with where it is going and what the state of their lives are, they won't continue to follow that leadership. I mean, religion is sort of caveat emptor. All of us are free to make a choice. I mean, Mormons are sending missionaries out all the time trying to talk people into leaving where they're at and coming to join us. And I think sort of natural forces will bring that about if the community is going off in a direction that is not supported by the leadership. Now, I would observe, I've been reading about, I haven't seen it or anything, but I've been reading about this compound that's been set up in Texas. I mean, I practiced law in Texas for a while. I know something about West Texas. Man, if they'd asked me, I would have told them that was not a good plan. I mean, this is a county of 2,600... This is a county of 2,600 Baptists who think regular Mormons have horns and one big eye in their forehead. And you drop 400 polygamists in the middle of that community, you are not going to get a good reception. I think they're going to have, problems there. But if that is in fact where the prophet Warren Jeffs is spending most of his time and he is not presiding over church meetings, that means that people in the community are seeing less of him, they are shaking his hand less, they have less contact with him. And I think one of the things that helps make people want to continue to follow your leadership is contact. And if you as a leader diminish your contact and start closing down the amount of time you have with your people you're attempting to lead, you're going to have a harder time persuading them to follow your leadership. And I think that's going to be an issue he's going to have to deal with if he's living principally in Texas or wherever. Yes?
The LDS Church is obviously an interest in disassociating themselves as far as possible with those groups of any kind. To your knowledge, does the LDS Church use pressure of any kind?
In the past, they clearly did. They were the driving force behind prosecutions. In the 30s, they were sending, basically they called people on missions to go out and spy on these people, and they were writing down their license plates outside of their meeting halls. They were turning this information over to law enforcement. They were checking birth certificates. And one of the things you find in some of the state archives is that the federal prosecutor, or the state prosecution files of the 1944 raid are the church surveillance files which were turned over to the cops to use in their prosecution. Okay, having said that, that is a time in the past. I think that stuff probably continued on up into the 1950s. I have not seen anything recently that indicates to me that there is any organized formal church involvement with these things. That doesn't mean there may not be your local bishop or somebody like that who's calling the sheriff up and trying to do something like that. But I think at the church headquarters level, I would be quite surprised if the church was mixing it up in any way in that area. And I think they would regard it as a mistake on their part to do so. And I think
if they were asked about it, they would probably deny it. But the shelters, the community, they kind of know. So,
so those communities would consider that pressure from the church?
Well, not pressure. Help.
Interference, maybe.
Interference, maybe.
Yes.
Over the last few years, Attorney General Goddard in Arizona and Mark Shurtleff in Utah have spent quite a bit of resources trying to find something on Warren Jeff that they can criminally charge him with. Although I realize a civil suit kind of opens up the door, and I'm sure they're hoping there's going to be something there. Do you think that if they had found anything at this point, that they would have just gone ahead and charged him?
I can't imagine that they would have passed the opportunity to prosecute him if they had something. I mean, my guess is they don't have anything. That doesn't mean they're not looking, but my guess is they don't have anything.
They have a full-time investigator in Utah now. Yeah.
Frankly, my impression, and I'm off in Atlanta, I get newspaper articles and so on and emails to me about what's going on. My impression is that it's been handled somewhat clumsily on the law enforcement side here, that if there were people willing to cooperate with them, they've been almost making an effort not to get those people to cooperate. So, yes?
I was told earlier by someone from Centennial Park that this recent coverage of the Lost Boys was somewhat contrived, that the boys were essentially bribed to say what they said, that they were brought up here, put in a hotel, given tickets to the lagoon, in exchange for them to say that the things they said about being driven out of the community.
I did not, actually. My daughter was getting married that day. But the Lost Boys that I found, there was nothing contrived. I didn't see any of those faces when I saw that news footage at the Capitol. I can promise you, I have never had such an emotionally jolting experience as meeting with those boys in that house in St. George and having them stream in while we were sitting there, newly dropped off by fathers and from Colorado City, almost like on a schedule.
Now, are these boys from Centennial Park or
no?
No. Other
I found nothing irregular in Centennial Park. Okay. Beautiful homes, happy children, lovely women. Yes, I want them all to be my neighbors so that they will take care of my kids. No, these are boys in this strange, you know, and they would come, brothers of boys who were already living on the floor and wherever, and it was like this little club, and I felt like I was in this house full of 20 of my sons, you know, and they would say, oh yeah, I got booted out because they found a video, or just little tiny, or I was out too late, or and they just arrived in droves. Well, and this was not contrived. These kids were, you know, they had no place to go, nothing to do. So I don't know about the kids that were brought up. I don't know about that project. But I can tell you that the Lost Boys I wrote about, I promise they're lost. They're darling and wonderful. But
I have less immediate contact with that issue. I have some sort of thoughts on it, though. I mean, you're talking about people, kids growing up in a fairly close community with less experience with the outside world than kids growing up here in Salt Lake or something like that. I mean, there are not a lot of Mormons in the South, but there are a lot of pretty conservative religious traditions in the South that have not dissimilar experiences. I think it is a mistake to attribute these. I mean, I do have the impression it's a bit overblown. I'm not suggesting that there aren't situations like that, but I've just got the feel it's a bit overblown. But I don't know that it is unique or peculiar to this community. I suspect that Amish kids, Mennonite kids, fundamentalist Baptist kids from other religious traditions may have some very similar experiences. They grow up in families that may view the world in sort of black and white, and they have a hard time with what they regard as transgressions, and the result may look a lot like that.
I suspect that. Well, I'm sure it's. I mean, we've got this new reality show on TV.
Oh, the Amish kids in L.A.?
Right.
Yeah.
And
you ready to kill your television yet?
maybe Mark Jeff is on to something. But it seems to me that there is the additional problem, though, of the fact that if you have men, if you have women marrying, multiple women marrying one man, then that does limit the supply of women who are available to men. You've got that. A group of males who cannot find a wife within that society if there are not enough, if the women are married to other men. And, you know, I sort of hesitate to make the analogy, but in China, we've got a situation where they were killing girl babies, and now we've got tens or hundreds of millions of men who can't find a wife, and what are we going to do in society over there? Now, I realize that the Centennial Park and Colorado City and Hilldale are not China, but in a society where there are not women to be mates for these men, you have a surplus of males. That seems to me to be a societal problem.
Let me respond to that on a couple of levels, and then I know you're taking in a breath like you had a thought on that too. One, I think with fundamentalist Mormons, like in the 19th century, people run polygamy up the flagpole, they get mesmerized by it, and they cannot see past polygamy. And they think that that's all fundamentalist Mormonism is about. That's not true. They have a whole bunch of issues that are of concern to them that have to do with priesthood authority, temple garments, a lot of doctrinal beliefs. There are a lot of very faithful, committed, believing fundamentalist Mormons that are in one-on-one marriages. So if you think that every household in a fundamentalist Mormon community is polygamous, you're wrong.
I've
been in a lot of homes in Colorado City that are monogamous homes. Sometimes the wives have made it clear to me they intended to be the only wife when we've had these private conversations. But they were still part of the community and still committed to it. The other thing, I'm not saying this makes up for the shortage of supply, but I have occasionally come across women who were single parents. They had been married in a traditional marriage out here in the world. It didn't work out, and they somehow ended up in Colorado City or in another fundamentalist Mormon community and became part of a plural family. I'm not saying that's a huge phenomenon, but I've run across it and not been surprised by it. When I talk to people, I wasn't surprised by it. So I don't know that the figures in terms of gender are so out of whack when you look at the whole picture.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. When you come down to
me, I'm sorry.
I know where it's okay.
The Mormon society at large in general, you can go to the Mormon churches and you have an overabundance of young ladies in their single ward. So there is there is a societal problem there as well. That each culture has its own societal problems should not be an issue, because the Mormon Church has an overabundance of unmarried women in their community.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm in the Atlanta ward, in the Atlanta stake. My stake is about a third black. My ward is about half black. Our converts are probably 2-to-1 women in my ward, and I don't think that's unrepresentative. I just think women are more interested in religion than men are.
There you go, Kate.
We're more interested in NFL football and NASCAR, I guess. So. Anyway.
But I did find there was a feeling among the boys that I got chummy with for that little period of time, that it didn't take much for them to be excused from their homes and their families and their communities, maybe because they were a threat to the older men. If they looked at girls on Main Street, if they flirted with them at all, that was a very bad thing. And some of the fallout of that was these boys would say to me, "I don't know how to date. I wouldn't know how to ask a girl out." And they were 19 years old. I wouldn't know how to do that, because that was something we weren't allowed to do.
I'm not real familiar with all of the details, but my experience is that young ladies do the same for you. They don't, or at least it doesn't appear, that they just kick out boys. The same behaviors young ladies can ask in the community.
And I found several of those young ladies who were chumming around with these boys. It was like a happy family because they had, you know, somebody, friends, who had a familiar background. But that's very true. A lot of the girls that I talked to, if you just ask the wrong question or say something like, "Oh, gosh, maybe I'd rather go to school than think about getting married." And a lot of the girls had just left, had figured out a way to to two of them that I talked to had figured out ways to literally run away, and they were too old for their parents to come and get them, and they sort of kept in touch with their moms a little bit, but they had no use for the community because the community had no use for them.
Let me tell you a couple of quick stories that are just sort of flip sides of this that I think help illustrate that there's another side to Colorado City. And these are involved families that are not in the leadership group. Vera Black, who's the subject of NRA Black, that really nasty Utah Supreme Court decision from the 50s, her youngest child is autistic. He's an adult autistic child. Needs basically home care all the time. I believe, I know the community down there built him a little house to live in by himself. Somebody comes to that community, usually a family member, and brings him a meal. This guy, he's a wanderer. He doesn't talk much, walks around town. He's going to be taken care of. This community is going to take care of this guy. He is not going to be the one. God forbid this man should have that disability in Atlanta, where I live, where he'd be a crackhead borrowing quarters from people outside McDonald's. I have to be careful how I say this. I have encountered wives who were someone was assigned to marry who I was pretty sure were mentally retarded, were low functioning. And I'm not sure that some of those women would have had that opportunity in another world. Now, that may be shocking to us in our world, and, you know, we look at it differently, but in a way it's sort of indicative of that community does sort of care for its own. I know another family where the mother is actually college educated. She was a school teacher, and she's a very committed plural wife in that community, and she's one of these families that broke up, but her husband, she's married to a man I'm quite close to now. But her son has spina bifida. He has lived much longer than someone with that disability would have. He's lost both his legs. He's in a wheelchair. He's sometimes in the hospital with very severe medical problems. He never lacks for medical care. They take care of him. When his mother remarried, I think a consideration in this home was to be sure this kid was taken care of, and the community has a job for him. He's a real nice kid. I say kid, he's in his mid-30s. But I've seen situations like that demonstrate to me that this is not a community where normally you get tossed on the streets. People get taken care of. Now, I realize there's this Lost Boys example, you know, and there's some conflicts in here. But my point is, I didn't see a lot of throwaway people in my exposure to that community. And I saw a lot of people that the community reached out to be sure it took care of.
And let me say, there are no rest homes anywhere down there. The older people are cared for in their homes, the sick people, the children.
Okay, let's take this one question.
I really enjoyed this counterpoint that you grabbed out of your book, and I thought very eloquent about that. One of the charges he makes is that of welfare fraud and leaving the bees, and the suggestion that they really don't and can't take care of themselves. They rely heavily on government subsidies. How do you respond to that?
All I can tell you is I have never been in a home where anybody acknowledged to me that they took any kind of public relief at all. I don't know that they would talk to me about it, but I'm sure I've probably been in 50 homes at one time or another. I mean, I have a wide circle of friends. I've never heard an acknowledgement of that. I have had leadership sometimes tell me, if they're eligible, we tell them they should apply. My ward, again, in Atlanta, I hate to keep using examples, is an inner-city ward with a lot of poor people in it. I'm sure we use our welfare payments a lot in my ward. A lot of people are dependent on my ward for support, and I know a lot of them are on public assistance. If you're eligible and you're in a community that's poor, I don't know why you shouldn't be eligible for those benefits. If you don't like the law and people are legally eligible, somebody ought to change the law. But if they're in compliance with the law and it's not a matter of fraud, why should they not be eligible for it? If it is a matter of fraud, prosecute them.
And you do find a large number of women that I talk to and in the community utilize WIC, the Women, Infants, Children Nutrition Program, but so do women, low-income women all over the country. I had the same experience, and just in shopping at the store and hanging out there, you know, a lot of WIC you would expect in a low-income community where there are a lot of children, but I don't know that it's inordinate.
Thank you. I wanted to thank everyone. I have one announcement before you leave. Anyone who is interested in the
Session tapes for session 335, Centennial Park Pluralwise Speak Out, will now be available for that session. It was announced earlier that they would not be taping it, but they did, and those tapes are now going to be made available. We'd like to thank our presenter and our respondent for coming. Thank you again.
Right outside the door, and if you're late or not, they may not be ready for another hour. Okay?